Or has it been any good?
It has for 116. We are, let me call this meeting to order, since I hit the gavel down, and we'll take recess later if we need to.
Okay.
Present are Representative Gardner, Representative Elkin, Representative Gatto, and myself, Chair Seaton. Representative Lynn is excused. He's on travel. And I'd remind everybody to turn off their cell phones if they have them. And today we'll hear House Bill 114, of Meyer, to present House Bill 116. So we'll begin with that.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning. Thank you.
Of the committee. House Bill 116 is called Youth in Action. The bill in front of you, I'd like to propose the committee substitute the CS for House Bill 116. And basically, what this bill is intended to do is protect minors who are working with peace officers as it pertains to sting operations.
Representative Elkin, would you like to move that CS for consideration of the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move CS for House Bill number 116, G version.
Thank you. That's before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The committee substitute, basically what it does, is it adds a second section to the original version, applying the intent to both instances of civil liability as it pertains to alcohol beverage status. The CS for House Bill 116 explicitly corrects an oversight in the civil liability provisions of AS 4.16.049 and 065. Last session, you may or may not remember, but I brought forward House Bill 428, which created a civil liability penalty for violations of Alaska Statute 4.16.060. Alaska Statute 4.16.049 and 65 allow a person with an alcoholic beverage license to bring civil action against a minor who violates the provisions of 049 and 060. And basically, that's a lot of mumble-jumble, but basically the activities that are covered here are a minor who is knowingly entering or remaining on a licensed premise, a minor soliciting others to purchase alcohol for them, or a minor presenting false identification. A minor who's doing these things, the business then can take civil action against the minor for up to $1,000. The problem is when we created these bills, we didn't exempt volunteers who may be working with law enforcement on various sting operations. These compliance checks, Mr. Chairman, I think are an important enforcement tool. It's good for us to have kids under 21 who attempt to buy at various places, because unfortunately, as we know, some establishments follow our laws better than others. In fact, I'm speaking from firsthand experience here. When we first got down, my family and I here to Juneau in January, went to A&P and got some groceries, and I thought, well, I'll just go next door and get a bottle of wine. And sure enough, a 19-year-old girl approached me and says, "Hi, I'm underage. Would you buy me some beer?" I think it was. And of course, I said no. Fortunately,
how much?
And then later, she pulls out her little card and said that she was with the Mad Youth for Action group. And sure enough, she was with the law enforcement person who was in an unmarked car. But the problem is that some of these kids who have been doing these sting operations for law enforcement, some of these establishments have actually tried to use the law that we passed earlier to take civil action against them because they're attempting to buy underage. So what this bill does, Mr. Chairman, is just try to fill that loophole. I don't think we ever intended for these establishments to take action against kids who were actually working with law enforcement on sting operations. So that's, in a nutshell, that's what this bill does.
Thank you very much, Representative Meyer, and we have been joined by Representative Ramirez as well.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Elk.
When you say some, how many are some? some people have been prosecuted under the $1,000. How many is some?
It'd be better to have somebody like Brown Jug here who, and other stores like I know Choku Charlie's in Anchorage. They prosecute.
Chokuch is a bar, so that would be different than a package store.
Well, it still falls under Title IV, but I don't know the actual numbers. I remember last year when we were bringing the bill forward, it was in the hundreds where Brown Jug took civil action against kids who were either attempting to buy or kids who approached adults to buy for them. But I don't have the exact number.
Mr. Chairman, for
yes, Representative Elkin.
Do we have
thank you. Could you tell me how many of the kids who signed up for this program may have been in trouble for minor consuming and were doing it to help clean their slate?
Let's see if I understand your question. How many kids were?
Well, let's say you got picked up.
Representative Elkins.
Oh, excuse me.
I got it right. Elkins.
A kid gets picked up for minor consuming, and they say, well, listen, if you'll go to work for us, we'll ignore this. So you've got two things. You've got a kid who maybe has been in that store or tried to get in that store before, so he's, you know, he might look and be close to looking 21. And I just wonder how many people who are participating in this program might have been in that position.
Representative Elkins, we do have Doug Griffin from the ABC board online for questions, and if Representative Meyer, if you can answer that question, that's fine. If you can't, I just wanted everybody to know that we do have someone else that we can direct the question to as well.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Elkins, I appreciate that, and certainly Mr. Griffin's in a much, much better position than I to answer that question. I do know that there have been one or two instances, I believe it's up in Fairbanks, and maybe Doug will know better, where kids were who were working on these sting operations, where the establishment actually did try to sue them for attempting to try to buy underage. So that's why this was brought to our attention. And certainly there's other people who have much more experience.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Meyer. Doug Griffin, are you online?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Appreciate that. Before we have you see if you can answer that question, I'd like to note that Representative Grunberg has joined us as well. Did you hear the question that Representative Elkins posed?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I sure did.
And can you provide us some information on that?
I can provide a general answer to Representative Elkins through the chair. Generally, that's not the way we do recruit our underage persons. In terms of someone who's been convicted of minor consuming and are using this as sort of a part of their community service or something like that. Generally, like in Juneau, we recruit them through the Youth in Action Program, through MAD. That's a source here. Here in Anchorage, we sometimes get underage military personnel who are interested in doing it. People from college campuses and some high school students, and so generally we get young people who have not had any kind of a criminal interaction or even a violation in some cases, but some type of a problem with alcohol. I won't say 100% certain that there hasn't been an underage agent who fits the sort of the description that Representative Elkins lays out, but generally that's not the way we recruit our underage persons. Usually we look for people that are volunteer, and we do pay them an amount like $10 an hour or something to work for us. That's part of our budget.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, to Doug Griffin. Good morning, Doug. Are you the only one to run this program, or is it sometimes run by local police?
Representative Elkins, through the chair, we have run it through local police, and it's still possible for a local police department to get their own grant directly to do this type of work. But since our movement of the ABC board over to the Department of Public Safety, we have opted to go with a state trooper or as the person running these operations. And we, up until about a month and a half ago, we had a dedicated officer doing this type of work. And we did that partly because we wanted consistency, quality control. We didn't want to run into some of the objections of trying to use underage people that looked to be over 21. We do not really wish to be deceptive in operating this program. We want to use underage persons that looked underage, that would go before a jury if need be, looking the way they looked the night they tried to make the purchase, and convince a jury that that person certainly should have been carded or, you know, asked for ID. So we do not try to operate this in any kind of a deceptive way. And for the record, it has been a successful program if you look at the failure rate, which has gone, when we first started out, was around 50%, and has now dropped below 10%.
Representative Elkins, does that answer your question? You're Representative Ramirez.
Good morning, Doug. It's your friend Jay. How you doing?
Very good, Representative Ramirez. How are you?
Very well, Director. Doug, as you recall, I came and testified to the Liquor Board against this several years ago when we were the object of a sting operation. And I do applaud you for the success of the program, but, you know, my contention at the time and my suspicion still remains that we're preying on a lower socioeconomic group that has less education, that's worried about diaper money. And if you could tell the committee, please, what the average age is of the folks that are participating in this sting operation, and also what is the average age of the license that they are presenting to the TAMS trained server suggesting their age. For instance, are they 20 and a half and they're presenting an ID that says that they're 29, or are they 18 years old and they're presenting an ID that says that they're 21 years old and 4 months? Can you tell us a little bit statistically about who you use and what kind of fake pieces of identification they use, and whether they're all Alaska driver's licenses or whether it's other out-of-state ID?
Okay, there's a bunch of questions there. I'll try to make sure I cover them all.
I have a bunch.
Rammers through the chair. We do not use fake ID. Generally, the younger age person will use their own ID, which shows that they're under 21, if we want to try to test the clerk regarding their math ability. In some instances, the underage person does not have any ID, and so when asked, if they are asked for identification, they say, "Oh, I don't have it on me. I left it at home," which again is a true statement. Sometimes that's the way the agent sets it up, but again, the person clearly looks underage and without identification should be denied the sale. The average age of the person we use is probably around 18. We do use some 19 and 20-year-olds. Again, if we are using someone that is approaching the age of 21, we want to make sure that they are attired, and if it's a female person, not heavily made up to look older. Again, our plan is not really to be as least deceptive as possible, and really to be not deceptive at all. That's why we prefer to call these compliance checks. We're sending someone there in that we believe is clearly underage, has the appearance of being underage, and in any reasonable TAM-trained or other alcohol-trained staff person would at least ask for their ID if they've got a corporate policy of IDing people that are 27, that look like they're 27 or 30 years of age or younger. That these people would certainly meet that description. But we don't use phony ID. We may use their existing ID, which, as Representative Meyer kind of described when he testified, sometimes gets seized by certain, or could get seized by certain of our businesses, based on the $1,000 civil penalty they can levy against an underage person on their premises. Let's see what else in terms of the questions. We prefer not to get somebody that's 20 and a half, actually. Actually, because if they turn 21, if the thing ever does go to trial, which is not does not happen a whole lot in terms of a criminal prosecution, even though it is happening more, if they turn 21 since the incident, that can sometimes be problematic. So we prefer getting someone that is not 20 and one half years of age.
Doug, Representative
Ramos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. Doug, first of all, it has succeeded. You know, it has made our server staff much more sensitive to the issue over the years, and so I congratulate you on the success of the program. The concern that I have is that servers work very hard. It's a highly skilled industry, maybe not quite as difficult as the fishing industry, but nevertheless it's tough. And so if a server who's got seven tables and a loud room gets an ID and somebody hands it to them, they often are under the perception that that person wouldn't have presented them their ID unless they were of legal age. That, you know, most folks would say, "Oh yeah, I left it in the car." That you wouldn't somebody underage would not present their piece of identification showing that they're actually underage. And I'm now kind of recollecting what my objection was to your program several years ago. So you're saying that if I'm 19 years old and I get carded, I present my ID that says that I'm 19 years old, and then I'm getting served nevertheless. Is that right?
Representative Ramos, through the chair, that's correct. I mean, we have seen people that clerk or that server may think the same way you've just described it. Well, this person's handing my ID, so they must be of age, and they don't look at the birth date, they don't do the math. Well, you know, that's unfortunate because that probably does happen sometimes when there is an illegal sale made that somebody's cool and does it and the clerk is just not doing their job in terms of seeing that they were born more than the date required for them to be 21 years of age. So that does happen, and we certainly understand that sometimes the situation of the server, whether it be in a package store or in a restaurant or bar, they may be harried a bit. And, you know, that's not really for us to decide. Maybe if they fight this thing, the prosecutor will make a decision not to prosecute somebody given circumstances that you describe of someone being extremely busy. But that's not really for us to decide. Our idea is that we're out there and we're trying to raise the consciousness of people that are in the alcohol business to be more on guard with regard to serving to people serving or selling to people that look like they could be less than the prescribed age.
And I would like to appreciate that information. It's really good information, but the bill that we have before us isn't addressing the basic question of whether we should have a bill that prevents people underage buying alcohol, but is whether we should remove from liability people that are working with the police to check this. So I just want to make sure that the committee focuses back on the bill that we have before us. But I appreciate the questions, and you're free to resume, but I would like to keep it in the context of this bill. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have three questions, and I think a couple of them are to Mr. Griffin and maybe one to Representative Myers. First to Mr. Griffin. The term on line 7 and line 13, quote, otherwise observes. Observation usually implies visual observation. Might you, instead of that, have a person wired and be listening to the operation? Or do you anticipate that happening in the future? And if so, should we have that covered in the terms of the bill too, Mr. Griffin, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that makes a good point. Typically, our mode of operation now, we do like to have our underage person being visually observed, but in some, you know, setups, that's not always good. I mean, you're talking about having to have a fair amount of windows maybe in the front of a package store for that to happen. But usually the officer is in a car outside the establishment or maybe, you know, even inside the liquor store at the time. But that is a good point, that there may be instances, I can think of some cases where there may be some instances given the configuration of some of our stores where they may not have the direct visual observation, and we would perhaps opt for some other type of evidence gathering, like the being wired or something like that. So that's a valid observation.
If this, we're going to move the bill, it goes to Judiciary, and I'll work with you and Mr. Representative Meyer's staff, Mr. Bitton. We'll work on some language to put in Judiciary, because that's going to take a little bit of work. Secondly, I don't think you guys are doing this, but I know they have similar kinds of situations for underage purchase of cigarettes, and I'm just wondering, and this may be addressed to either you or Representative Myers, if we should consider similar protective language for law enforcement people who send minors in to purchase cigarettes. Mr. Griffin, are you able to answer that? Or if not, I'll just direct that to Representative Myers. Mr. Griffin, through the chair.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, that is outside our jurisdiction. We have some, obviously, because our program is similar to the operation run by the Department of Health and Social Services with regard to tobacco. You know, we have had some discussions with them informally, but to get an official response, you should contact someone over in the Department of Health and Social Services that operates that tobacco reduction program.
Mr. Chair, one more to Mr. Gruenberg, and I'll go into Representative Myers. And I know there is such a program, as you've said, concerning the purchase of tobacco products. Let's say law enforcement people, and I don't know whether it be you or the department or police or whoever, want to conduct a sting-like kind of operation at a bar, whether they're selling cigarettes to underage people. Is that ever done? And if so, who does it? Would that be you or the department or somebody else?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, yeah, we do not engage in any type of activity involving tobacco. So, and to my knowledge, the tobacco folks don't engage in any kind of activity involving the sale of alcohol. So we both do our own thing separately. But as you recognize, you know, just as a sideline, one of our biggest problems are underage people that are 19 years of age going into liquor stores to buy tobacco. They're legal to buy tobacco, but they get their ID seized because they're not supposed to be in the liquor store, and they claim that they didn't know that. But be that as it may, they're still subject to the $1,000 civil penalty that Representative Myers has guided through the legislature and put into Alaska law.
Well, I would just then to Representative Meyer through the chair.
Representative Gruenberg, follow up.
I will just say that we can chat about the observed issue physically as opposed to auditorily. Secondly, if you want to do anything with the smoking, which might not be a bad idea. And third, I would suggest we take a look at the title because we may want to narrow that title down, unless you want to keep it broad for some reason. No. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Meyer, did you have something to... Response.
I was just going to comment. I agree with everything Representative Gruenberg has mentioned, including tightening the title somewhat. The only thing on smoking, and certainly, as you know, I'm concerned about youth having access to tobacco almost as much as the alcohol. But I don't believe we have the civil liability with the tobacco as we do the alcohol. We can still look and see if there's some way to incorporate that.
Okay. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Griffin, just a small question. Do we have, or are we doing things like sending out underage youth kind of just on a patrol? Let's say they frequent a store. They don't have enough money to buy the liquor, but they come up to the register and they go unchallenged, then they simply say, oh, darn, I didn't bring enough money. But then you're able to then return with a peace officer who then can observe this happening. So I guess the question is, do we have anyone unaccompanied, unobserved, and unwired simply patrolling the area to find where maybe they should concentrate their efforts?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, that does not comport with the way that we operate our program. It's all very controlled. Our underage people are well briefed. We hit your places generally at random. We may know based on information that comes to our office of places that we suspect may be more guilty of selling to underage people and maybe provide some more attention there. But generally we will blanket all the stores and try to do some restaurants and bars as well. And it's all done very controlled. We don't do anything of reconnaissance that you're talking about, Representative Gatto.
Representative Gatto, follow up.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. So the only other thing I'm thinking is with regard to the statement otherwise observed, kind of like a cockpit voice recorder, is it possible to say a person is otherwise observed if they come back with a voice recording or actually even a video recording the way cameras are coming now, or even a photograph or something like that? Would you consider that otherwise observed?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, I that may be a legal opinion that someone, perhaps a member of your committee, may be better equipped to answer. As I said in response to the point raised by Representative Gruenberg, we don't use the recording equipment now. It's not to say that in some cases it might not be useful to have that and to use that, but presently we try to have not direct observation. It's just we know the person's in the store and we have a police officer or a trooper nearby, and that's the way we conduct the operations presently.
Thank you.
Does the committee have any other questions for Representative Meyer? I know he has a time crunch here. We have some people to testify as well. And I just had one question. I guess your staff can respond to that. But on page 1, line 12, where it says, if a person performs an act prescribed under this section, does that under this section refer to participating in this project, or does this prescribed under this section refer to purchasing of alcohol?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Michael Pawlowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. I had called legislative legal about this, and it's prescribed because a person is performing an act under Section 060, which is a list of the actions. So they're acts prohibited by 060 by that section.
Okay, so then we're talking about an act that of purchasing alcohol, which is under that section.
Precisely.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that we had our wordings all right. Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, and Mr. Pawlowski, I'm sorry I called your name wrong. I certainly know who you are, Fish. But the question of proscribed means prohibited.
That's correct. I wanted to make sure we were talking about the correct act here and not the act that this bill talks about. So I don't see any other questions for you, Representative Meyer. Thank you very much for presenting the bill. If your staff is available to remain, that would be good. We do have Cindy Cashin here to testify on the bill. Good morning, Cindy. Would you identify yourself and who you represent for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Good morning. My name is Cindy Cashin. I'm the executive director of the Mad Juno chapter, and I'm here before the committee this morning to show support for House Bill 116, sponsored by Representative Meyer, and to answer any questions by the committee. Our Youth in Action members participate in the compliance checks and they're trained before they go in. I have gone on these compliance checks with law enforcement and observed them, as well as our Youth in Action coordinator, to ensure that this is done fairly. We use Youth in Action children, teenagers, and we pick specifically the ones that look young. For instance, the compliance check we had with Representative Myers, we had a 14-year-old with braces. So I guess I would say we try to be as fair as possible and not make this a sting, but rather a compliance check, such as, you know, food establishments, lodging establishments. We want to make sure that the laws are being observed, and it's with satisfaction we are finding that they are. And when they are, we publicly thank them and personally thank those clerks and liquor licensees who are observing the laws.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gashin. Does anyone have a question? Thank you for your testimony today. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House Bill 116? Do we have anyone online? Okay, then I will close the public testimony at this time and committee discussion.
I did
Representative Elkins?
I did, Mr. Chairman, I did want to ask Doug Griffin a question if he's still online.
Doug, are you still online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Representative Elkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doug, could you tell me in how many cases did the minor buy liquor inside the store, and how many times did they approach people outside the store to go in and purchase the liquor for them?
Representative Elkins, through the chair, I don't have those exact numbers on me. I can work to get that data together and get it to you or get it to the committee. The shoulder tap, the experience that Representative Meyer described, is kind of the next step up. If you look at this sort of as a hierarchical thing, once you start getting clerks well trained, which of course is really the main focus of our board, because these are licensees we're talking about, and we want their staff to deny sale to underage people in all instances, and perfection is probably unattainable, but we're very pleased that we're getting it down below 10%. The next thing you do is to try to focus on the people, the underage people, or the people that are willing to buy for underage people, knowing that that could lead to a big problem. So the shoulder tap is, I can say generally, is a new thing. It's sort of the next level that we've just begun kind of trying that, and I think maybe in Juneau this last time when the session was just getting started and we had our operation down there, that we were using it pretty much for the first time. I think we've just begun doing that. For the most part, our operations involve just a straight compliance check of sending an underage person into the establishment and seeing if they will properly be denied sale. But I can certainly try to get that information available to you. It's predominantly we've done the straight compliance checks. I would say probably 90-95% of the time, the shoulder tap of getting an of-age person to buy for an underage person is a relatively new thing that we just started using.
Representative Elkins, follow-up?
Doug, I was always under the impression that statistics showed that most minors bought their liquor from the 21, 22-year-old peer group.
Representative Elkins, through the chair, that there are statistics studies that have been done by the Century Council, which is a group that's supported by the liquor industry. That doesn't necessarily mean that their data is poor, because I probably would agree with their conclusion, but I think that their most recent study did show that 65% of the alcohol provided to underage people are provided by parents of older enough friends or siblings. So we recognize that the compliance check thing is certainly not going to in and of itself solve the problem of underage access to alcohol. It's simply really the easiest one to do, and we are looking at using some of this money that we have to do underage access to alcohol, the problem of that, to go to media and do other things. We don't want to be a one-trick pony and just do one thing. I think to get at the whole problem, compliance checks is a piece of it. It's in some ways the easiest piece, but that just because it's the easiest piece to do doesn't, we recognize, doesn't solve the entire problem. The next thing is to try to educate the public about the problems of someone buying alcohol and providing alcohol to underage people. And that is probably, there's ways, many ways you can do that, but we're probably going to focus at least initially on a media campaign. And we are working with AFN and several other groups up here, including MAD, the Mental Health Trust, and some other groups to try to put together a pot of money to do some media with regard to underage, providing alcohol to underage people.
Thank you, Doug. And I think we have one more follow-up from Representative Elkins.
Yeah, one more, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be quiet. Doug, overall, how would you rate the TAMS program for success or failure?
Representative Elkins, through the chair, I think the TAM program is certainly not perfect, but I think it provides understanding and a certain level of understanding and professionalism to people that sell, you know, alcohol. I mean, that's one of the challenges is some of the people that are in this business don't necessarily make a high wage, but to know that they do have to, get this training and at least have some basic information about checking IDs and the laws pertaining to alcohol in Alaska, I think is a good thing. And we're certainly better off have it than not. It's not perfect. You don't learn everything you probably need to know in a 4 or 5 hour class, but I think it's good that we have such a program in Alaska.
Thank you.
Doug, one thing, people are talking in script here again, so would you explain what the TAMS program is for us?
Well, it's one of about three alcohol server programs that the ABC board has approved for provision for people that work in the alcohol industry. It's a program that you is required after a certain period of time being on the job, where there's a little bit of a grace period under state law. You have to have this type of training, either TAM, techniques of alcohol management is probably the most popular course, but there are other approved programs. And then you have to recertify every 3 years to have that CAM card. And when someone from the ABC board or a police officer comes into an establishment, you are required to have proof that you have a current alcohol server training on you, similar to a driver's license.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Gatto has a question.
Yeah, Doug, just nothing to do with the bill, just a curiosity. I'm looking at the person who actually makes the sale and accepts the money. If we were to compare those people at the cash register and said we had two groups, those which were very close to 21 and those which were maybe 30, 35, 40, as far as the rate of allowing alcohol sales to people underage, is there a difference between among the people that are possible to hire?
Representative Gatto, I'm not sure I understand your question. You're talking about the age of people that are hired to be clerks?
That's correct. I'm just looking at it and saying, if I were an owner of a store selling alcohol, and I sure had to avoid getting hit by you people, if I could use that word,
sure.
Would I then say it's smarter for me to hire someone who's 35 because they are going to make sure we don't make a mistake, and is someone who's only 21 more likely to make a mistake? Or I guess what I'm after is there a difference in that person that you're finding in your statistics?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Representative Gatto, through the chair. I don't know that we've tracked The age of clerks that have failed and have made a purchase to an underage person, that might be a good academic exercise to do. I don't know that we've done that. I mean, I think you're talking about someone who really cares about their job and wants to do a good job. I could see advantages to having someone who's just turned 21 or 22 and that they might know a lot more about who's, depending on the size of the community, who's of age and who isn't, just because they're closer to that age group. And you can have some very, conscientious, responsible 21, 22-year-olds and some very sloppy and not very caring 35-year-olds. So I certainly wouldn't want to jump to any conclusions regarding the age of the quality of a person to be in the position of selling alcohol based on their age. But you do raise an interesting question I hadn't really thought about, and we haven't done any kind of statistical analysis looking at the age of clerks that fail, even though, again, because a citation is issued, which would include the birth date of that clerk, or alcohol server, that data or that study could be conducted.
Okay, and Representative Gatto, a follow-up?
Oh, and I'm sorry if it got confusing. I was just thinking, if you got stung one time, maybe you should hire Grandma, who absolutely will never let any kid get by with anything, or should you hire the 21-year-old, like you said, who says, I know you. You're a 12th grader, but you know you're not going to buy liquor here. And it was more a curiosity on my part. It won't affect my vote. Just a curiosity. So thanks very much.
Are there any other questions, Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, and maybe these are either to Mr. Griffin or Mr. Pulaski, since Representative Meyer isn't here. Maybe you'd want to come on up through the chair. We have been given a copy, and should be in everybody's packet, of AS04.16.065, civil penalty for violations of AS04.16.060. Since one of the main purposes of this legislation, the bill, House Bill 116, is to say that the minor should not be subject to a civil penalty, would it not be a good idea also to add a subsection E to 065 specifically saying that?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, again, this is Michael Pulaski from Representative Meyer's office. Since the civil liability in 065 doesn't trigger until there's a violation of 060, we felt in working with legal that creating the specific clarification in 060 that a person does not violate 060 or does not violate this section by performing acts prescribed under this section, then it's a bit of a loop, but since you have to violate 060 to get to 065, if you don't violate 060, then we think we're covered.
I understand through the chair, if I may dialogue with Mr. Pulaski for a moment.
Representative Grunberg.
I realize technically you're right, and Mr. Lockhop, the legal counsel, is technically right. I am thinking strictly in terms of giving a little bit additional notice, because we're dealing here with three groups of people. We're dealing with young people, we're dealing with clerks, and we're dealing with people in the industry, none of whom are technically lawyers, with a few exceptions, the bar owners who are lawyers.
Representative Gundry, maybe we need just back up a little bit. Are you saying that the clerks need more notification that they're not to serve alcohol?
No.
Are you saying that they need more notification that they can't sue somebody that's working with the police?
In a way. No, I wouldn't put it like that exactly, Mr. Chair. What I'm saying is that the purpose of this legislation is to provide some immunization and some assurance that if a young person goes out and works for the ABC board in conducting one of these operations, and it's not a sting, but I forget what it's called.
Compliance check.
Thank you. Compliance check. I want to be politically correct and legally correct. Compliance check. That they're not going to be hit with a civil penalty. And if I were a parent of a young person, and a parent who happened to be a lawyer and be looking in a law book, I'd look under civil liability, and I would not whip back and forth to 060. And I am thinking that it might be a good idea. And I'm again looking at what we can do in judiciary, Mr. Pulaski, really talking to you, that we probably ought to have something in here that specifically in 065 that specifically says that, because otherwise it's going to, I think, have some confusion. And my other question, I'm just sort of putting that on my list here, but the other thing is, and this is really addressed to Mr. Griffin through the chair.
Yes.
These people who do these sales, these actual bartenders, servers, they go through these training. Is there a statutory requirement requirement in regs that they have training?
Yes. Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, yes. For most liquor licensed establishments, they have to have trained personnel.
And what statute is that in, through the chair?
Well, the regulation that we have regarding it is 13 AAC 104-465.
As far as you know, there's no specific statute on that.
Yes, oh, yes, there is a statute. I'm looking for that right now. It's 04-21025.
I've got that here. Alcohol server education course. I am not familiar with that, so I'm going to ask a follow-up question, if I may.
Sure. I just want to make sure that we're on the violation.
Yes, we are.
Prohibition here. Okay. Proceed, yeah. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. Is there any provision in 04-21025 that says that if a dispenser, if a person sells to a minor, they can be ordered to undergo additional training?
No, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, no, that is not spelled out.
Would it
that
be?
May be something that occurs by the licensee, may require their employee to undergo further training. Very often the clerk is simply fired relieved of their duties, but that's something that is very often we do find happens, because besides the criminal citation, we issue a notice of violation to the licensee as an administrative action, and the NOV requires a response, and very often the response we get back from the licensee is that the clerk undergoes retraining if they are retained as an employee.
A final question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Is it? Would you like to have a authority in 025 to order the licensee and or the clerk to have additional training if they make such a sale? Would you like an amendment to that statute to specifically give you that authority?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I guess I would like to think about that. I mean, I think the board certainly has the authority to do that now, and maybe, you know, there you can debate whether we should exercise that more now. Something in the statute, you know, making it clear that the board has that option obviously makes the statute clearer that it's there as a possibility, but I guess I as a blanket thing, I would have to think about that because circumstances, I mean, we're not totally heartless. Representative Ram has raised some concerns about under certain circumstances mistakes can be made, and maybe given a certain set of facts, you look at each sale to an underage person based on the facts. But something like that, I leave that up to you as the lawmakers to decide. It wouldn't hurt. I'm not so sure that it's necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and I do want to bring everybody back to the point that we are not, the bill that we have before us relates to exempting liability for someone that's involved. We're not establishing the crime of selling alcohol to underage people. So just want to bring us back to the title. Yes, Representative Rammers.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, and I don't have any questions for Doug, although I do want to congratulate the ABC Board on just a splendid approach over the last few years, because they've been very successful in their compliance. Nevertheless, I'm going to oppose this, and I'd like to tell the chair and the committee why while we're in discussion. And it is no disrespect to the ABC Board. I'm a huge fan, and we are very interested in compliance. But we've touched today a little bit on the difference between the word compliance and the word sting. And having been on the receiving end of this, it's semantics, but sometimes semantics are important. I'd like to tell you, if I could just have a little liberty, Mr. Chairman. I was flying home on Friday to Fairbanks, and I was sitting next to two young people, and I was on the aisle seat. The young man who was in the window seat was a National Guard kid from Wasilla, who was down here getting training. He's being deployed to Iraq in a year, and he's a non-drinker. The young woman in the middle seat was a young woman. Her family was from Russia. She was turning 21 years old that night. She was on her way. She lives here with her in Juneau with her boyfriend. She was on her way back to Anchorage to go out drinking to celebrate her 21st birthday with her friends. And I listened to these two young people converse. And she talked about that she was going to go to all the clubs that she had frequented for the last several years by using her older sister's identification. And she was afraid to tell them that it was her 21st birthday because all of the security people would recognize her and they would suddenly realize that they had participated in allowing an underage person into their premises over the last year. So what we're involved with here is a young person who is intent on breaking the law, which none of us want, because 21 is barely a responsible enough age to consume alcohol, but that's what the law says, and we're not discussing that today. The concern I have, and I touched on this with Director Griffin, and I just think the world of Doug and what his staff is doing, and they're so well intended. But in their letter here from the ABC Board, it says here in the second paragraph, it says the one tactic that has been raised by liquor licensees that do not like this increased oversight and enforcement is the claim that law enforcement agents are breaking the law to enforce the law by sending underage persons onto licensed premises. And I guess that's my issue. If it's going to be compliance, I'm so in favor of somebody who is 21 years of age going into a liquor store or going onto a licensed premises and saying, can I have a drink, please? And if the bartender says, where's your identification, and or the server, and they say, well, I left it in the car, I don't have it, then I'm 100% interested in prosecuting those folks. But I am just perennially concerned with the people that are in the food service industry are often there because this is the best industry for them to work in. And if you do statistical research on them, you find that, and we're not talking about professionals, I'm talking about just the facts of life, and I employ hundreds of these people. And you get a lot of single moms there, you get a lot of people that have completed their GEDs. Like we have a young woman working for us. I'm real passionate about this, Mr. Chairman, and it does relate to this, so I apologize for going on. But we have a young woman who she's just testing with FedEx to try to get over there, and she couldn't do their application. My manager's husband, he's the general manager for FedEx, and she had to get her GED in order to qualify for the FedEx application. And she's a nice single mom with two young kids, and she's trying to get out of the food service industry to get, you know, the benefits that come with a Fortune 500 company like FedEx. And one of the qualifications was to get her GED, and she worked real hard on doing that. And so the concern I have is that although this is well-intended, and I appreciate what Doug and the ABC board are trying to do, is that to a certain extent we're preying on a vulnerable sector of our community, which are people that haven't yet got their GED. And they're struggling. You know, this is a young woman. She smokes, right? So she's got to worry about getting cigarettes because she's addicted, you know, to nicotine. She's got to worry about getting diapers. She's got to worry about rent. She's got to worry about, you know, insurance so that she's legal to drive her car. She's trying to survive. And when a person presents their ID to you, it's like a Psychology Today puzzle. You look at it, and you're like, oh, they're giving me their ID. They must be legal. And yet they flunk this compliance test. Whereas somebody who says, oh, I left my ID in the car or I left it at home, they're guilty. You cannot serve that person. And I have no tolerance for somebody being served without identification. And but I worry that it's that inadvertently, you know, we always talk about unintended consequences here. And for me, that's the great concern of an unintended consequence, is that we're inadvertently targeting people that are vulnerable, that they're just concentrating on so many things and their job and trying to get by, and they've got a hostile kitchen and they've got, you know, happy guests and they've got unhappy guests and they're in a hurry. And somebody who is, you know, underage presents them their own ID and they're like, oh, and they look at it and it's how long do you look at a piece of ID for? I mean, we all, in the industry, we all try to maintain, you know, the liquor companies all provide us, you know, the born on dates. You know, if you were not born on the date 1981, you're not legal to be served, or 1984, or whatever it is. But the server looks at this identification for a split instant. And the problem that I have is that I have professional bartenders that work for me who, if somebody who looks suspicious, like they're underage, they will take that piece of identification and they will take 15, 20, 30 seconds to make sure that this is that person. They'll do the mathematics that this is the right age, and they'll say, oh, you can't drink here. You're underage, or, you know, this ID looks suspicious to me. It's an out-of-state ID. So the person that we're preying on is somebody who's been in the industry for a very short period of time. Yesterday in another committee, Mr. Chairman, we were talking about people that go out on commercial fishing boats that have never been trained, that are more subject to injury than professionals, you know, that have been in the fishing industry. And that's the concern that I have with HB 116. With all due respect to the sponsor and to the director of the ABC board, who I support unconditionally in their effort to keep underage people from getting alcohol, because I hate that. But part of this preys on the wrong people, and it's like if we could ignore Miranda rights some of the time, we could really bust a lot more bad people. But we have to observe Miranda rights all of the time. And right here in this letter, there's an acknowledgement that we are the claim that law enforcement agents are breaking the law to enforce the law by sending underage persons onto licensed premises. We shouldn't be doing that. We should be sending in 21-year-olds to say, hey, can I have a drink? And if they get served without identification, we should nail them. But short of that, I just don't approve of it.
I just have a question.
Yes, sir.
Because I'm not really familiar with the law. Is the law that you can't serve to someone under 21, or is the law that you have to check everyone's ID?
Both. You know, that's why you'll see, you know, we ID. You know, it's a huge program in the industry. You know, we ID everybody. You know, I got ID'd here in town a week ago and was, you know, pleased, like most of us that are well over the age of 21. And so it's both. It's definitely illegal to serve under the age of 21. And as far as I know, I don't know if it's in statute that you have to card somebody. It's just certainly is prudent.
Well, yeah, and that's practice. That's my point, Representative Ramis. I think that what it is prudent business practice is the card to make sure you're not violating the law by serving someone under 21. So if someone that's over 21 went into an establishment and was served liquor with or without an ID, is that going to be a violation of the law? Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair, most establishments have a form that that person can fill out swearing that they are of legal age. And if they're not, then you can prosecute them. But if the ABC board comes in and checks that and verifies that they are 21, then the owner of that establishment is off the hook.
Well, I guess, you know, we're in committee discussion, and I guess what I'm not following here is, as I understand the law, is you can't serve somebody under 21. So what we're saying is you want to change the law so that you can't serve somebody without ID and allow them to serve someone under 21, or to remove the statute that you can't serve somebody under 21. Because if you have to send somebody in that's of legal age to get a drink, there's nothing to prosecute somebody for. And so I'm confused at where we're going.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative.
I'm not sure what the statute is. Doug might be able to tell you, but you have to be able to provide proof of age to be served, if requested. And that's why they have that form. If for some reason you have left your wallet at home, but you are of legal age, you can fill that form out. And
it's obvious that the law can't be that you have to card everyone. Otherwise, every time you go into the bar or get served a drink, you would have to be carded.
Yeah.
And so, the card must be looking at identification is a way to prove, for your knowledge, that someone is of legal age to drink. And I guess we're just really getting carried away here from the from this bill, because this bill is looking at enforcement and not allowing a civil penalty for someone who is participating with the police officers in the compliance check. So, I mean, I guess that's what we're saying. I mean, do we want to? Is the purpose of the objection to say that the establishment should have the ability to take civil action against someone that's working with the police? Is that what we're wanting to maintain? Because that's the only thing that I see that this does. It says that civil action can't be taken against a minor who is working with the police to work on a compliance check.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I think that everybody in this room is very much aware that the state has an alcohol problem that causes a great amount of heartache and problems. We also, as a state, have agreed that we have a minimum drinking age, and we have a lot of statutes that work to enforce that. And the ABC board, as part of, and law enforcement, have a lot of programs to help with compliance for the law. And while I applaud my colleague's empathy for his servers who have all kinds of problems and issues that they're dealing with, the fact is if they're serving alcohol, they have to comply with the law and assure themselves and the establishment that the people that they're serving are of legal age. The bill before us is simply to protect those elements of law enforcement who are working, or protect the minors who are working with law enforcement, to assure that our laws for underage alcohol are complied with. And I think it's a really simple kind of thing. This is one tool that's used, and I support it.
Okay. Representative Gattis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whew. First of all, I have to say I have a lot of respect for Representative Ramirez, and especially for his single mother worker with a tobacco addiction and has to buy diapers. And I know that woman, and she has a twin sister who doesn't have any addictions, and she doesn't work in your industry, and she's walking down the street, and for 26 years in an ambulance and a fire truck, I have dealt with so many traffic accidents, I cannot count them. But I will tell you this. It is often an innocent person who is the victim of a person who is either drinking too much or drinking too young. And that person can be injured just as severely as any other person. And when that happens, that becomes a very difficult situation for society. But for me, I will do a lot of things, and I'll certainly vote in favor of this bill to make sure that these operations are able to continue without jeopardizing the individuals who are necessary to make them function.
Okay, and I do want to try and bring us back to this bill and removing civil liability for those people participating with the police. Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Chair, at the risk of chiming in very briefly, please. You know, the problem of that's mentioned in this letter that we have, the February 15 letter from Mr. Griffin, that cites the liquor licensees who claim that the law enforcement agencies are breaking the law to enforce the law. That is a problem and a logical conundrum that faces us innumerably, in innumerable instances in society, when people have undercover agents go out and buy drugs, when they have johns go out to arrest prostitutes, when they have underage people go out to buy cigarettes, you know, when we engage, our people are involved in clandestine activities and there are murders and stuff that our people participate in. This is a problem, and it is something that society needs to think about, and I'm glad to see the industry is thinking about it.
And Representative Gruenberg, I just might state that this bill that we have before us clarifies that these people would not be breaking the law. Because if we pass this, then they are not breaking the law if they're working with law enforcement, even though they're under the age of 18. So there's an exception that is built in by this bill to the law, and so that would clarify
yes,
that.
And that's, Mr. Chair, if I may, yes. That is correct. And the other statute that we have that's in our packet is in the criminal law generally. That you're right, that is the answer, and the statute we have is in Title 11 that says there is a defense to a criminal statute, 1181-420, that says that conduct which would otherwise constitute an offense if justified when it's required or authorized by law or by a judicial decree, judgment, or order. That's how society deals with this.
Hey, is there any other committee discussion on House Bill 116? Representative Gatto.
Speaker, I move committee substitute for House Bill 116, version G, with individual recommendations and any attached physical notes as amended, if there are any amendments.
There were no amendments. Are there objections?
Yeah, I'll object.
We have objections. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yes.
Representative Gatto?
Yes.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Lynn, not present. Representative Rammer?
No.
Chair Seaton?
Yes.
5-2, yay-nay.
No.
4-2.
Excuse me, 4-2, yay-nay. Thank you.
I think we have 4.
That's good. 4 and 7.
Yeah, we've got 4. So the bill passes from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. And
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The record should reflect that's a majority of the full committee.
Yes, that is. That's for the majority of the committee. And we'll send that around. Thank you for joining us.
Mr. Chairman.
And thank you to Representative Meyer. Next on.
Chair, I'd just like to thank the committee for indulging me to, you know, really express that. I appreciate that a great deal. Thank you.
Appreciate your comments. You know, these things are always difficult, and it's good to get the diversity of all the comments on the record here. Thank you. Next we have HB 114. And in the governor's office, Drew, and would you please identify yourself and introduce the bill for us? Thank you.
For the record, I'm Marcy Kanai, Deputy Commissioner, Office of Children's Services, Department of Health and Social Services. And I have with me
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Diane Olson. I am a Chief Assistant Attorney General and the statewide supervisor for the Human Services Section. We primarily represent the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today about House Bill 114. House Bill 114 includes several distinct provisions relating to the child protection system. Each constitutes a step toward making Alaska's children safer, healthier, and more secure without unreasonably expanding governmental powers. This proposal amends AS 2523-180 to permit parents to relinquish their parental rights to a child while retaining certain privileges, such as ongoing communication or visitation with the child. This proposed amendment is in response to a recent Alaska Supreme Court decision holding that the current law prohibits a parent from retaining any rights or privileges in a relinquishment. In some cases, ongoing contact with the parent is in the child's best interest, especially when that child is adopted by a relative or a family acquaintance. The proposal also adds language to AS 4323-005 to allow children who are placed temporarily by the Department of Health and Social Services outside of the state in out-of-state treatment facilities in order to maintain eligibility for permanent fund dividends. Some children require long-term treatment of a nature that is currently unavailable in Alaska, and such children are at risk of losing the PFD eligibility if they remain out of state in excess of the statutorily prescribed period of time and are unable to return to the state. The department feels that these Alaskan children should not lose this privilege as a result of having been placed in that treatment facility, which is not available in the state. House Bill 114 also adds language to Alaska Statute 4710-020 to clarify that the court may issue any orders necessary to aid the department in its investigation of an allegation of child abuse and neglect. It's important to note that orders to aid the department are not prohibited by existing law. However, the proposal would resolve any ambiguity toward the ability of judges to issue orders across the state through various jurisdictions. A new subsection is also added to AS 4710-020, which clarifies that the department is not required to obtain authorization from the court to conduct an investigation of a protective services report, formerly known as a report of harm, or to file a petition in court. Existing federal law requires a testimony of a qualified expert witness in order for the court to authorize the out-of-home placement of or termination of parental rights to an Indian child. And this proposal adds a new section to AS 4710-145 that permits the courts to conclude as a matter of law that the testimony of a qualified expert witness would support a finding that placing a child with a parent who cannot be located, is absent, or is unknown would place that child at substantial risk of harm. And finally, this bill amends the definition of the term mental health professional in AS 4730-915 for purposes of child in need of aid and juvenile delinquency proceedings. In order to authorize placement of children in secure residential psychiatric treatment facilities, the court must hear the testimony of a mental health professional. The current definition excludes professionals who may be licensed to practice in states other than Alaska. The testimony of such professionals is often critical in cases in Alaska in cases involving Alaska children who are already placed out of state by the department. The expansion of the existing definition is necessary to ensure that Alaska children who are placed outside of the state receive the psychiatric treatment that they need. I'd be happy to answer any questions committee members may have about this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions?
I want to have a minute to look at this, if I may.
You've just gotten passed out from Legal Services a memorandum about CS, and you've got a CS for 114. No one's had a chance to read this, and so we're going to ask some questions here today, but we're going to hold this in the committee so that we have a chance to read the CS.
Yes, I'll
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the expert witness part of this bill. And can you just clarify, and maybe you've already done so and I missed the fine points, how this bill would change the ability of an expert witness to give testimony or maybe have conclusions reached about placement with absent parents being against the best interest? What would be different?
Okay. Representative Gardner, through the chair. Under the Indian Child Welfare Act, it's currently required that in order to place a child in foster care or to terminate parental rights, there must be evidence supported by a qualified expert witness that the returning the child to the parent is likely to result in serious physical or emotional harm. In the case of an absent parent or a parent who, and certainly a parent who's not in court, parent who may have been absent for a period of time to be determined by the court under a clear and convincing standard, it's simply a matter of common sense that you cannot place the child back in the care of that person, that the department has no idea where they exist. Current practice is, although the statute of the Indian Child Welfare Act does require the testimony of a qualified expert witness, the practice throughout the state is, well, first of all, in most of the cases, we reach agreements with the parents and the tribe and the guardian ad litem. And in those stipulations that are in written form, because the Indian Child Welfare Act requires that, the parties agree that had the matter proceeded to trial, the department would have been able to present clear and convincing evidence supported by a qualified expert witness that returning the child to that parent is likely to result in serious emotional or physical harm. And we do not actually present the testimony of that expert. This case is a little bit different because you don't have that parent in front of the court to make that stipulation. And yet, the courts understand that it's simply a matter of common sense that you cannot return the child to that parent. And so what this amendment would do is allow the court to make a finding as a matter of law that that the child cannot return to that parent, and would keep the department from having to present a qualified expert witness. Some judges have determined that that expert witness still needs to be heard and at a cost to the department, and so we present those witnesses. Some courts in other states have determined that social workers alone don't meet the requirements of an expert witness under the Indian Child Welfare Act. And so in order to avoid that kind of a problem, we've had to spend money to have somebody say what we all know to be true and what the courts know to be true. So that is what this proposal is intended to accomplish.
So in follow-up, it...
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. It simply eliminates the necessity of having an expert witness, and it codifies, if you will, the assumption that if a parent's absent, then an expert witness is not needed.
Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you.
Through the chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, to follow up on what Representative Gardner has said, the language of that Section 5, and I haven't really studied the bill, although I have practiced in this area, I'm not certain that I'm totally comfortable with the language, and I can't tell you why. And I would like it very much if you, Ms. Olden, could provide to us a copy of that recent Supreme Court decision that you mentioned relating to Section 1. That was the one you talked about a minute ago, wasn't it? It was a recent Supreme Court decision from the Alaska Supreme Court that led to the proposal in Section 1.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, and that was in reference to the relinquishment, the retention of rights. Okay,
yeah, and secondly, if there is a case or cases that relate to Section 5, I would like to see those also. Actually, we have access to all the cases here in the Judiciary Room, so if you can just fax me or email my assistant or to me today as quickly as you can the sites on those cases, I'd like to take a look at them. Peter, I'd like you to pull those up for me.
And I do have a citation for the Keith M.W. case with regard to the relinquishments.
Sure.
Which is 79 P3rd 623.
79 P3.
623.
And name of the case?
In re Keith M.W.
KMW?
Yes.
Okay. And that brings me to another question. On section...
Reverend Gutenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On section 1, the sentence beginning on line 13, page 1, that it seems to divest the court of jurisdiction to invalidate such a relinquishment. And we just dealt in Senate Bill 56 with another attempt to divest a court of jurisdiction. And I have some serious problems with divesting a court of jurisdiction. And I'd like any authority you can find, and also the wisdom of divesting a court of jurisdiction to invalidate something. I can see, first of all, I have problems with the policy of that statute, that sentence, because where you're saying here on the top of page 2 that the retained privilege has been withheld from the relinquishing parent. You could have a kid who is in state custody and they promise the parent that they're going to have visitation, and then the state deliberately withholds the visitation from that parent, and the parent has no legal recourse at all. I think that's terrible public policy. Why would you justify that?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, this section is intended to apply to a relinquishment that is taken prior to an adoption. And these relinquishments are, as a matter of policy by both the department and the Attorney General's office, would not be taken unless they were agreed to by the adoptive parent. The reason that you would not want to allow these to be withdrawn or invalidated is a matter of public policy as well with regard to the security of the adoption. And I think that there's currently, and I can get this statute as well, I believe that there's currently a state statute that does not allow an adoption to be overturned for any reason after 1 year. And under the Indian Child Welfare Act, even there it's 2 years if it's a matter of duress. And I believe the public policy behind that is that once a family adopts a child, you want to make sure that they're secure in the fact that that adoption is not going to be overturned at any point in the future. So there may be other remedies for a lack of compliance with that adoption order, but we just do not believe that terminating or invalidating that adoption decree is the appropriate way.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gutenberg.
The current statute that allows an open adoption was, I authored that in 1986 when we revised the Adoption Act, and we had a conference committee literally that lasted the entire session on the, we couldn't agree on the amendments to the Adoption Act, and that was one provision we could agree, but we ultimately did pass the bill, and I chaired the conference committee on the House side. So we already have a provision that allows conditions for retaining privileges. This seems to would seem to apply, and my question is, if that's the intent, and we will have to talk about this, because if that's the intent to allow the retaining of privileges, then why is this Section 1 necessary at all? That's already in state law. Secondly, there's a one-year statute of limitations in the Adoption Act. This would seem to run contrary to that. If right now you can set aside adoption for various reasons, including fraud and duress, which this seems to include, why are you snarfing that off immediately, and why not allow that to go forward 1 year? Third, this may very well be unconstitutional if it were intended to conflict with the federally enacted Indian Child Welfare Act, which would retain supremacy under the Supremacy Clause. I've got some serious problems if that's the intent of this section. We can talk about that later.
And we do have a CS that you were just given as well, just that, I mean, we just received, this was not sprung on you at the last minute because we just got it over here. It's dated February 28th, and it addresses some questions as far as with the Indian Child Welfare Act, and also It's putting into legislative language the rest of the bill. So I would like you to look at that. Representative Gruenberg has addressed some questions here, and if you could get back to us in writing on those and with his office. But I would like to get a synopsis of where we're going with that section and how you interpret that as well, just so the whole committee has that discussion instead of, you know, just trying to talk about it here. Representative Gruenberg.
May we take a brief 1 minute?
Brief at ease. Back, come back and to order here, and so if you could address those things and address the legal questions that are brought up in that by Ledge Legal on that CS, we'd appreciate that. Does anyone else have any questions on this bill? Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Just one other thing, and that is the section that deals with the qualified expert. I do have some concerns about that also, which we'll take up separately, but I did have a question I'd also like you to address where you talk about the burden of clear and convincing. Oh, excuse me. I will withdraw my question. Thank you.
Thank you. And by the way, I forgot we had the introduction of this bill, but we do have three people that have signed up to testify in the bill, so we'll take that public testimony now. So if you will remain, then you'll hear that testimony as well. Yes, Representative Rammer.
I wanted to ask a question. Ladies, about the permanent fund eligibility. I read in the sports page yesterday there was a commentary about athletes that we have training outside that are no longer eligible for their permanent fund. And a couple of weeks ago, Representative McGuire had introduced a bill about Peace Corps volunteers and other folks that are on missionary work. Why are we drawing a distinction between those groups and an individual who is in custody of the Department of Health and Social Services and placed outside of the state for medical and behavior treatment?
Representative Ramos, through the chair, I'm not sure that we've actually thought about that or thought that there was a distinction. Primarily, of course, we were thinking in terms of the children who were in the custody of the department and sent out of the state, sometimes against their will, sometimes against the will of their parents, and thought that this would be a good opportunity to resolve that issue for them.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions at this time? We will hold this bill over. And let's see, we have Linda Wilson. Are you off net here? Are you online?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, hi, Linda. Appreciate you coming. Would you identify yourself, who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony?
Thank you, Chairman Seaton. This is Linda Wilson. I'm Deputy Director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. I've been an attorney with the agency for over 20 years. I currently supervise the family law section in Anchorage, which is sort of a specialized section that includes attorneys who represent parents in child protective proceedings, so the parents in cases that this bill affects. I also supervise attorneys who represent juveniles in juvenile delinquency cases. That's personally my background. Before I became deputy, I handled juvenile delinquency cases. So I don't have a lot of experience in child protective cases, but I supervise the unit. And we have, as a unit, reviewed this bill, and I wanted to bring to the committee some of our comments and concerns regarding this bill. And I think that the committee members have hit on several of those areas. Certainly, we support some aspects of this bill, the Section 2 allowing for PFD eligibility for these kids that are placed out of state, both as child in need of aid kids and juvenile delinquency kids, certainly is a good provision. The spirit of Section 1, the part that has to do with retaining privileges in a relinquishment, are well intended, and we certainly support that. There was a common practice in the past in open adoption situations where, in order to resolve a child in need of aid case that was heading towards termination, if the parties could agree, they would enter into a relinquishment and allow for the ability to retain a privilege to visit or contact the child post-adoption. This Alaska Supreme Court case, Keith M.W., called that into question, and this puts in the relinquishment statute the ability to retain a privilege. The problem is that it doesn't do as much as it could. Retaining a privilege that really is not enforceable, has no teeth in it, is sort of saying, you know, it's almost like false advertisement. You're telling the parent you can retain a privilege, but it's not enforceable, and you can't void the relinquishment or the adoption with it. It would be better, I think, to try to put something in the adoption decree. I think the policy behind finality in an adoption is a sound one. And so the fact that you maybe couldn't void the relinquishment or the adoption may be a sound policy. But I think there needs to be something in the adoption decree to require that visitation, if it's in the best interest of the child, be enforceable. So that down the road, if the adoptive parents are withholding visitation, and that's not in the child's best interest, that a biological parent could initiate some action in the probate court that handles the adoptions to try to get that visitation that they thought they were going to get when they relinquished. So I think, you know, we could try to see more done to this. But I think the spirit of that section is a good one. Allowing the ability to have retained privileges is a sound one and a common practice that we would like to see continued. But it'd be nice if it was had more teeth in it, if there was something that could be followed up in the adoption statutes that would make it more enforceable. So certainly would look forward to perhaps staying in communication with the members of the committee and working with the sponsors on seeing if there's any way to do that. The next section I'd like to talk about, which is in the original bill, which is Section 5, having to do with the expert witness. And again, I appreciate the insightful comments by the members of the committee. What this would do is basically take away this qualified expert from the scene. And this qualified expert witness is required under federal law. Under the Indian Child Welfare Act, the state has to put on an expert witness. To eliminate that requirement and allow the court to make it a matter of law that there's no need to have this qualified expert, I think has some problems with it. Ms. Olson stated that in cases currently it may be stipulated. Well, stipulated is very different from having the court impose it without a stipulation. Certainly if the parties disagree with eliminating the need to have a qualified expert put on the stand, it's probably not appropriate to allow the court to just eliminate that element that the state must prove in a termination proceeding. So I think there are problems with this, and I think the reason you have a qualified expert required are some good reasons. So I'm troubled by that section that eliminates it, even when there's no agreement by the parties that it can be dispensed with under the circumstances in each individual case. But to take that away without consensus, I think, is problematic and may run afoul of what the Indian Child Welfare Act requires. So concerns with that section of the bill. I'm certainly available for any questions that the committee members have, and thank you so much for allowing me to contribute my comments.
Well, thank you, Linda. We appreciate that very much. This is a complicated matter, obviously, with a number of different sections in here. And so we might call on you to participate in a little more here. We might form a subcommittee to look at these problems in a little more detail, a little working group. Seems it may be more effective to get that sharing of information than the formal committee setting. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a quick question, Ms. Wilson. If absent parents have attorneys appointed to represent their interests, even though the attorney may never have met with the parent, could that attorney stipulate to an agreement to dispense with the requirement of an expert witness in the absence of the parent?
Well, I think that they... Good question. I suspect they could. I could see some problems with a stipulation like that, having never communicated with the client and then taking action without having consulted with them on how you wanted to proceed. It would be, I think the attorney could, but I think there are many attorneys that would have a problem doing that.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, in response to Representative Gardner's question, I know one attorney sitting at this table would have a real difficulty doing that, and I think that attorney, any attorney that did it, ought to check with the bar and their malpractice carrier, because I don't think you can stipulate on behalf of a client that you've never met. I'd have some real problems with that. Secondly, with respect to the standard of clear and convincing evidence, my recollection is that the Indian Child Welfare Act requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And my question to you, Ms. Wilson, is whether in grafting here a state law lesser standard of clear and convincing evidence, whether that violates the Supremacy Clause.
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, I believe the standard of clear and convincing evidence has to do with the specific fact of whether or not the parent can be located. I don't think that language in the statute affects the beyond a reasonable doubt requirements that are in the Indian Child Welfare Act for other things that need to be determined under a beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Thank you.
Okay, and we do have two more people with the Attorney General Office anyway, is one that's here. Diane Olson?
We just heard from her.
Oh, okay, Diane and Marcy. Oh, I thought we had three people testify. Is there anyone else that in the audience here that wishes to testify on House Bill 114? Do we have anyone else online that wishes to testify on 114?
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes. Representative Grunberg.
I think that when we take up this bill, either in committee or subcommittee, I'd request that we also notify the Office of Public Advocacy and the Family Law Section.
Right. Representative Gardner, did you have something?
No.
Also? Okay. I think that we will. This is going to be dealing with several matters that are quite technical. So, Representative Gatto, would you be willing to serve on a short subcommittee on this bill? Okay. And Representative Gardner, you'd like to serve. Is there any other members that would like to serve on the subcommittee? Representative Grunberg, and Chair will be a member also. So, or I'll be kind of sitting in sometimes. But you'll be the chair of the subcommittee, Representative Gatto. And we will try to work on this soon so that we can bring it back before the committee, important piece of legislation. And we will, Linda, will you be available for some teleconferencing on that issue as well?
Sure. I would make myself available, and I will certainly contact the Office of Public Advocacy and let them know about it as well.
Great. And we just have your, would you mind sending an email to my office so that we have all the contact information right for you?
Certainly.
Thank you very much. So we'll hold House Bill 114 for further work of the subcommittee. And again, that's that subcommittee will be chaired by Representative Gatto, and we'll have, as other members, Representative Gardner, Representative Grunberg. And now we will take up House Bill 121, Second Class Boroughs. Hello.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Casey Schroeder. I'm a legislative aide for Representative Thomas, and I'm also one of the committee aides for the House Community Regional Affairs Committee.
Could you state your name again, please?
Casey Schroeder.
Casey Schroeder. Okay. Thank you, Casey. Would you go ahead and introduce the bill?
Yeah. Basically, the background behind 121 is that when the state revenue sharing program was in place, residents of subdivisions that were outside of city limits were able to rely on state money to form road service areas. But now that the revenue sharing program is over, they're no longer able to rely on state money, and some of these service areas are not taxing themselves adequately enough to maintain services in their roads. So without adequate services for the roads are deteriorating and becoming unsafe. And it's important to keep in mind that these service areas are not separate legal entities from the borough. So the borough actually bears the ultimate financial responsibility for the service areas. But on the other hand, the borough can't assess a borough-wide tax and apply it to these service areas to help them out. So while they bear the ultimate financial responsibility, they don't have the power to dissolve or otherwise remedy the issues that present themselves when service areas are not performing their functions properly. So what House Bill 121 does is it allows boroughs, second-class boroughs, to consolidate or abolish service areas that are either non-functional or at functioning at below minimum standards. But at the same time, it also protects those service areas that are taxing themselves adequately and performing their services adequately.
So. Thank you, Casey. You said that the borough couldn't tax and distribute to the road service areas. Was that because of taxing power that they don't have or that they can't allocate money?
Actually, I'm not exactly sure on the specifics of the taxing scheme for the borough, but Renee Broker is online, and she's the Fairbanks North Star Borough Attorney, so she could probably answer that a lot better than I could.
Okay. Thank you, Casey. Is there anyone else that has a question for Casey on presentation of the bill? We do have several people to testify. Yes, Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just on the substance of this bill, does it address groups or areas that are capable of taxing themselves and simply are not required to, so elect not to? Is that the essence of the bill?
Yeah. They do have the power to tax themselves, but they're electing not to, and therefore they're not performing their services adequately.
And I understand that before there was revenue sharing that was distributed to those. Did the revenue sharing go to the districts themselves, or did the revenue sharing go to the borough and then distributed, or are you aware of how that works?
Chairman Seaton, I'm not exactly sure how it was distributed.
That's fine. We have other people that will be able to answer that question for us. Thanks. Representative Elkin.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, shouldn't we adopt CS for House Bill number 121, CNRA?
Well,
that's the bill that's before
us. That's what we're talking about. I mean, for the record.
That's the bill that's before us. That was the bill that came from CRA. So we have that bill before us.
Okay.
It's not a new CS for us. Okay. So, yes, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the difference between the CS and the original bill?
Through the chair to Representative Grunberg, the CS simply adds an effective date.
Oh. I just spotted that.
Okay, if there are no other questions for Casey, if you can remain, we'd appreciate that. Reneva Moss, are you available to testify on the bill? Good morning. Appreciate you coming. Can you identify yourself?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Reneva Moss. I'm here this morning as the chairman of a road service area in North Pole. I've been following this bill. I do recognize that the borough does have a problem with service areas that choose not to tax themselves, choose not to maintain the roads. I'm sorry, blasting you away. But they do create a safety hazard for the borough. Those roads are roads that are used by ambulances, fire trucks, school buses, and there is the chance of something happening and the borough being held liable. This bill is really about the fact that state statute allows people to form service areas and maintain their roads, but it does, under existing law, put the borough in a spot when they don't abide by the rules. So this simply gives the borough an opportunity to get rid of the risk of being responsible for service areas that aren't maintained. The reason I'm following this is I wanted to be assured that this was not going to disrupt service areas that do their job properly. And I am very comfortable with the language here that it does protect service areas that are doing their job right and allows them to continue doing their job. And your question, Mr. Chair, about revenue sharing, that was money that was appropriated to the borough, and then the borough distributed it on a per-mile basis. Any questions?
I did have a question. The taxing authority is really the borough's taxing authority that then they let service areas vote to exercise, but that the taxing authority is really on the borough. Is that correct?
Correct. The borough is the one who sends the bills out. The service areas determine what the mill rate is for road maintenance.
Okay, and the boroughs can allow or not establish road service areas? I mean, the road service areas, are they a totally basically independent function of, or is it permissively established under the borough ordinances?
Mr. Chair, if I understand your question, service areas are formed by election of an area. The boundaries are set. The rural services does assist areas in deciding what the boundaries would be, and then the borough clerk arranges for an election. And there are statutes that determine when those elections are held.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for serving on an RSA. I did the same thing. And just for clarification, I'm curious to see if Matsu and North Pole or all service areas do the same thing. We had a board that was appointed by the borough mayor, and we met four times a year or as often as necessary, and hopefully at least four times, and we decided what the mill rate would be for taxing ourselves to do grading, snow removal, paving. We also approved LIDs, then submitted that to the borough for approval. So if we picked a quarter of a mill, the borough then would approve it. So I guess the question is, what is happening? Is the RSA board submitting a request for zero and the borough is accepting that? Or is the RSA submitting a mill rate and the borough is rejecting it and making it zero? And so one of those two.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, what is happening in Fairbanks is we have several service areas that don't even have boards anymore. Once the money dried up, the boards just became dysfunctional. So no decisions are being made. Actually, I shouldn't say that. Part of the problem was that the borough felt they had a responsibility to make some of those decisions. And actually, statutorily, they didn't have the authority to do that. So they were authorizing maintenance that wasn't necessarily legal because they felt they had a responsibility to keep those roads safe. But the service areas that don't have any money are, I would say, a large percentage of them are service areas that do not even have boards anymore.
And it's a little off subject, but what happens if somebody submits an LID, which you know is a local improvement district, which says we want to pave a certain number of roads and we get borough matching? If there's no board, but a community decides let's pave the main road leading into a subdivision, are we saying that can't be done anymore by dissolving the board?
Yes, you are saying that.
Mr. Chair? As I understand this, there's nothing to prevent a new service area from forming again or requesting the borough to form again if they have funding and if they want to serve the function. That's correct, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner?
Thank you. Do I understand correctly that what this bill would actually do is simply eliminate the liability that the board currently has for unsafe conditions, but it in no way addresses the issue of unsafe roads?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's correct.
Thank you.
Are there further questions for Ms. Moss? Yes. Representative Grimm.
Or this may be for the sponsor's representative here, one or the other. If the service area is abolished, then the borough itself would remain responsible, say, for the roads. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, no, that is not correct. That's the purpose of this bill. Right now, a service area, as long as it exists, is not a separate entity from the borough as far as liability. So the purpose of this bill is to dissolve a service area that creates some risk, and that takes away the liability from the borough.
Who is then through the chair, who's then responsible for maintaining the roads?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the borough does not have road service powers. Therefore, nobody would be responsible. And I might add, there are hundreds of roads in the borough today that do not fall under service areas. In the North Pole area, I can speak to the Alaskan spirit in those areas. Usually the neighborhood takes care of the road themselves, maybe not up to standards, but they certainly group together to plow the snow and haul in some gravel in the summertime.
Thank you.
And just might note that there's, you know, different classes of boroughs, home rule, first class, second class. This is, my understanding, this only addresses second class boroughs.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it addresses second class boroughs. Renee Broker can speak to this, but home rules operate by charter, so they do have the capability to do this, just in a different manner.
Okay, thank you. Is there any, Representative Ramos?
Thank you. Reneva, I just wanted to thank you for coming to testify. It's a pleasure to always see you. And I just wanted to reiterate this is a significant issue in Fairbanks as the full support of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly, and it allows the empowered road districts to continue to serve their area locally and exceptionally. It allows the borough to step in.
Thank you.
Yeah, we are going to run out of time here, so I would like to hold committee discussion and get to the testimony. Thank you very much, Reneva. We have Kevin Ritchie. Okay. And we have Renee Broker. Are you online?
Yes, I am. Good morning. My name is Renee Broker. I'm the borough attorney for the Fairbanks North Star Borough. And the Fairbanks North Star Borough enthusiastically supports this bill. We have 107 reasons to do so, and that is because we have 107 road service areas. We're the unquestioned leader amongst municipalities in that regard. And as been previously mentioned, we have been confronted with the cessation of state funding with some service areas that are unable or unwilling to tax themselves, fill positions of commissioners, and so have essentially become legally non-functional and or dysfunctional, and that we don't believe that it's ever a good policy decision to completely separate control from responsibility, which is where the borough is at right now with its service areas. So we're just simply urging that we regain some control, but continue to respect the autonomy of those service areas that are functioning as legally intended.
Thank you, Renee. Appreciate that. Does anyone have a question? Thank you again. We have Dan Brockhorst on. Are you?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Dan, would you go ahead and identify yourself, and do you have any testimony to offer us on this bill?
Very brief remarks, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Brockhorst. I'm a local government specialist with the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The department certainly endorses the measure to give borough governments the flexibility needed to provide for the efficient delivery of services, and this bill certainly does that for second-class boroughs. However, the department wishes to make two observations about the bill. First of all, there is nothing unique about a second-class borough that would suggest that the measures in the bill are needed for that particular class of borough, but not for other classes of borough. It was noted earlier in testimony that home rule borough governments have the capacity to exempt themselves from this provision, but under AS 2935450 subsection D, that whole section does apply to home rule borough governments. And if we consider, for example, that the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, it is currently a second-class borough government, but there is a petition that is currently pending that would change its classification from second-class to home rule. So under this bill, if this bill were to pass as a second-class borough, the provisions would be allowed or extended to the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, and that the Assembly would have the authority and the capacity to deal with the concerns and problems that have been discussed with regard to the bill. But if it were to become a home rule borough government, then those provisions would not be extended to the borough assembly. And that leads me to the second observation, that the bill as written gives greater flexibility and authority to a general law, second-class borough, than it does to a home rule borough government. And under Alaska's Constitution, home rule is certainly intended to provide for maximum local self-government. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my remarks.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. And we do have an email from you that we'll be looking at, and we will hold this bill over for analysis, and we'll close the public hearing on this bill, and we'll have committee discussion next time. And thank you for your attention. We're adjourned at 10:02.